So the few things we're going to talk about on this call, we're going to get into the assessment. We're going to talk about, you know, you, your results, why you're good at what you So again, we're going to go through the information. If you have questions, if you have something that's burning and you need to speak up and you need clarification or I wasn't clear about something, please feel free to break in and say something. But otherwise, we'll take questions at the end. So the number one thing we were going to talk about is why you're good at what you do. So how does your DISC style tell you what your qualities are, what your strengths are? How does it know you so well, number one? A lot of people read their DISC report, and they can't believe how accurate it is, not only with your strengths, but sometimes with but just on a one-to-one basis. And when you start interpreting a profile, you just look at the natural to start with. Okay? But we're going to talk about that a little bit more. Okay, so now let's talk about number two on the form is how to communicate, unless there's more questions on the graph, because we are going to get into interpreting the graph in a minute. Any burning questions right now? Okay, then feel free to ask me in the next section. So the next one we're going to talk about is how to communicate with the different styles, because one of the biggest ways to use DISC is to obviously understand our own style, but then to start recognizing the other three styles so that we can alter our communication with people. Because once we can adapt and give people what they need in communication, it increases our ability to get our message across, relate to people. Sometimes people are kind of in their mode and we don't know how to communicate for them. Once you learn that, you can get someone's attention. You can be much more persuasive and kind of, get your point across once you can get through that doorway of communication with people. So it's important to know, what is it the other styles like in communication and what is it that they don't like in communication? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you words that work for each of the styles and words that don't work, like the kind of words you actually want to avoid when talking to these other styles, okay? So what we'll do is we'll start, the next page has the same thing. It's got a chart or a table with four styles with C, D, I, and S in it. And I'm going to give you the words for those. So let's just start with the C, because we never start with the C. Up in the left-hand corner. The kind of words that'll work with a high C, again, remember their focus is on information. That's what they need. So when you're talking to a high C, you want to talk about the data. You want to say, like, the data shows da-da-da-da. You want to quote research and, like, give them the, where the research was done. I often will have high-compliant people call me out on the fact that I wrote somewhere that research shows. The first thing they'll say is, what research? Give me the source. I want to know the source. So for the high-compliant people of the world, you have to state your source when you're quoting research. You want to talk about statistics. You want to talk about history, like history shows. Because high-compliant people put a lot of weight in precedence, and what's happened in the past and what worked in the past is very meaningful to them. The words that don't work for high-compliant people are things like hypothetical. You don't want to ask them hypothetical questions. It would drive them crazy. Educated guess. Okay, they're not interested in your educated guesses. They don't like it when you're being clever. Okay, that's just not something they respond to. You don't want to use the words I feel or my opinion is, because they don't put credibility in feelings and opinions. Remember, they're very, very logical. Okay, let's talk about the high D's. So words that work with high D's, anything to do with change. You know, we're going to change this. We're going to, take a look at how we do this. Let's do this differently. Let's do this better. Let's do this faster. So anything where you're going to improve productivity or efficiency or anything like that is going to respond well with a high D. You're going to want to use the words quick. You're going to want to focus on results. Anything to do with urgency, they always respond to something urgent. And they like new and innovative things. So when you can talk to a high dominant person about new and innovation, especially if you're selling. If you're selling to a high D, you definitely want to focus on brand new and innovative products. That's what they're going to like. Words that don't work with a high dominant, in my opinion, again, they don't care about your opinion. Follow directions, they're not interested in that. Lots of detail, they will actually shut down and stop listening to you. Structure and rules. Anytime you're talking about those types of things, high dominant people will tune out. The best thing to do with high dominant people is keep it short and sweet. Give them the bottom line. The high C's have got to stop giving them so much information. The high I's have to stop giving them a lot of stories because they just don't care. They're really looking for the bottom line. So you just want to give it short and sweet. Executive summary. Those were written for high dominant people. Okay, words that work for high influence people. I trust you. We can do it using positive and encouraging words. testimonials work for high influence people, because they, now here are the people that do put weight in other people's opinions, so that is important to them, especially if you can use a testimonial from someone they know, someone they admire, or someone they like. That's going to go a long way. Words that don't work for high influence people are things like theoretical, one size fits all. That's not appealing to a high influence person. they want to be seen as unique and special, so one size fits all doesn't appeal. This is going to require study, or this is going to take a lot of time to understand. That's not going to work for them. Alone time, that's not going to work for them. Again, these people need interaction. Words that work for a high steadiness person. High steadiness people, you're going to want to talk about inclusion. You know, people being included is important to them. Again, these are people that want safety and security. So anything about security, insurance is big for them. Traditional, if you're talking about products or something like that, you know, traditional, proven, tried and true, all those are types of words that would work with a high steadiness person. Words that don't work with them would be things like play to win. That would respond well to a high dominant person, but not high steadiness. Revolutionary, that's too much like war, and high steadiness people are usually the peaceable people in the world, so stay away from words like that. Don't ask me why, just do it. That's not something they would respond to. Exclusive, you know, talking about exclusive or one-upping someone or being better than someone else, that, again, isn't going to work for a high steadiness person. So here's what's really interesting about the DISC model, and you might have already picked this up on your own, but if you look across the table from, you know, one from the other, so like the D and the S, they're in opposite quadrants. If you look at the words that work for the high dominant person, those are very similar to the words that don't work for the high S person. The words that work for high Ds do not work for high Ss. Same thing with the high influence, high compliant. The words that work for a high compliant person are not going to work for a high influence person, and vice versa. So you start to see that this model, there's a lot of opposite characteristics when you jump across the table like that, when you look at the different quadrants. And that's actually going to become really important to us when we get into looking at the wheel that's in your in the back of your profile. That's going to be important. Okay, any questions on that? Probably pretty self-explanatory, and probably you've picked that up intuitively, that sometimes you talk to someone and you say something, and it just doesn't land well over there, and you go, now, what did I say? Because that seems to work for me. As we will see more and more, people are not the same. So is your adapted style working for you? So now we're going to talk a little bit about the graph. So if there's more questions, that's great. Three pages, again, from the back of the last page of your assessment, are your two graphs side by side, natural and adaptive. So your natural graph is your basic behaviors. This is who you are. Let's say when you wake up in the morning, if you were to go about your day, not being influenced by anything else, okay? So this is like when you're just being yourself. That's what's depicted in your natural behavior. And yes, natural behavior can change over time, as you go through different circumstances, what they call significant emotional circumstances in your life. And that can be anything from, taking a new job, changing locations, getting married, getting divorced, having a child, losing a parent, retiring. All those types of things will shift your natural behavior, okay? But what I have found, I think is true in 99% of the cases that I've ever seen, and I've been working with the DISC tool for 12 years now, is I have not seen people's core style change. So, for example, when I first took a DISC assessment 12 years ago, I was 100% high I. And then my second factor was compliance, and dominance and steadiness were both below the line. Every time I've taken the DISC assessment since, and I take it yearly, my I is always my highest. It's usually 100%. Every once in a while, it'll bounce a couple points down, maybe 5 points down. But it's always my highest. And since I started my own business about 6.5 years ago, my compliance has gone down to below the line, and my dominance has come up to above the line. So what's happened is my secondary and my third factors changed, but my core has not changed. And if you talk to my family members, I'm the youngest of 6 children, and you ask my brothers and sisters, what was I like when I was a little girl? Them describing me is like describing a high eye. They're like, you were so happy, and you were so friendly. I was very independent. I would go up, you know, I was 3 years old. I'd go up and I'd talk to people. Here's the best story of all. When I was 2 or 3, my siblings told me so much that I was pretty that I thought that was my name. When people would say, what's your name, little girl? I'd say, I'm pretty. And they'd say, how old are you? I'm pretty. Like, that was my answer for everything. That's such a high eye. So we can see that that stays pretty consistent throughout your lifetime. What will change, though, is those other factors. What changes often and every day and from situation to situation, environment to environment, is going to be your adapted graph, okay? So if you were thinking of work when you took this assessment, then what shows up in your adapted graph is your adapted work style. But you adapt everywhere you go. Most people do. So the question is, well, how do you interpret that, you know, one graph to the next? And if I'm adapting, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, I get that question a lot. So basically, you can look at this and you can say, factor by factor, how much are you adapting? Okay, so if you compare your D score to your natural graph to your D score in your adapted graph, what's considered a significant adaptation is 20 points or more, or if you cross the midline. Okay, so if your D goes up or down by more than 20 points, or it crosses that 50% line, because that's called the energy line, so you go from a high to a low, or a low to a high, that's a significant adaptation. So what does that mean? Well, high dominant characteristics, if your dominance is going up, it's very simple. You're becoming more dominant. Something in your environment is asking you to be more dominant. You're being more assertive, more aggressive, more results-oriented, much more focused on the big picture and strategy and things like that. Is it a good thing? I don't know. You got to look at your environment. You've got to look at your job and ask, is that how I should be adapting in order to be successful in this environment? If your dominance is going down, same thing. You're becoming less aggressive. You're more laid back. You're more relaxed. You're kind of waiting for things to happen. You're more mellow. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. Look at your environment. What is your environment calling for? If you were in outside sales, let's say, and your natural dominance was, let's say, 55%, and in your adapted graph it went up to 75%, I'd say that's probably a good thing because you probably need more dominance in a position like that. If your dominance was going down by 20, 30 points in that same scenario, I would ask you what's going on. Why is your dominant going down when your work environment most likely would be calling for more of it? So those are the kind of questions that you have to ask yourself to realize, is this a good thing or a bad thing? The influence score. So now look at your influence score. Is it going up in your adapted style? Is it going down in your adapted style? Or does it cross that midline? If your influence score is going up, it means you're becoming much more sociable, friendly, outgoing, enthusiastic, more optimistic. You know, you're kind of looking at things from a more positive viewpoint. You're becoming more trusting. If your influence goes down, the opposite's happening. You're becoming less trusting, less optimistic, more maybe focused on working on your own. Maybe there's not as much interaction as you would like in the environment. You know, maybe you're into details or data or something like that. Your job's calling for that, so there's not as much of the people interaction. Is it a good thing? I don't know. You have to look at what's being expected of you or what you need to be doing in your work environment. Steadiness score, that's going to measure your pace and your response to change. So if your steadiness is going up, you're actually becoming slower paced and more methodical in how you do things. So maybe you're working on something that requires more concentration and more focus, and you've really got to buckle down and pay attention to something right now. If you're lower steadiness, or if your score is going down, then you're picking up the pace. You're actually multitasking more. You're working on more projects. You're probably trying to get more done, so your energy level is up, and you're working at a faster pace. Compliance going up in your adapted style, and again, we're talking about more than 20 points, so it's a significant adaptation, means that now you're paying attention to things like details and rules, procedures, accuracy. Sometimes I see compliance go up when a team's, you know, going through budget time or something like that, and all of a sudden they've got to pay attention to some numbers that they didn't have to pay attention to before. But something to remember, too, with compliance going up is the emotion behind compliance is fear. So sometimes if a team is all shifting towards compliance, that's something I kind of like to dig into and find out, is this really, you know, kind of a requirement in the environment, like, you know, budget time or something like that's happening, or is there really something causing fear in the environment? Because that can be an indication as well. Compliance going down will mean that you're becoming more independent, more outside the box, less likely to follow the rules and details. You might know they're there, but you're kind of working around them. So you're becoming a little bit more radical in how you follow rules and procedures if your compliance goes down. The last thing I want to mention about adaptations is that there's two different reasons people adapt. One is a strategic adaptation, and one is a reactive adaptation. So if you're doing it strategically, it's because you've looked at the environment and you've said, well, in order for me to be successful, you know, in my role, in this team, with this person, whatever, I need to adapt this factor up or down. That's gonna serve me well. If you're doing it reactively, it means you're not, I think the difference is awareness. You're not aware of it. You're doing it in response to the environment. And of the two, obviously reactive adaptation is more stressful, okay? So sometimes people are adapting quite a bit, and they say, well, I don't, you know, it doesn't stress me out. I feel fine. Well, that's probably because it's your choice. But when people are adapting extensively, and I mean, you know, all four factors going up and down, or when we get to the wheel, they're jumping across the wheel. If they're doing it out of survival mode, they're just trying to make it through the day, there's a lot of stress involved there. So what you can do with DISC as well, we keep talking about different applications, you can assess risk of a team or of an organization by doing people's DISC assessments and seeing the extent to which people are adapting. Okay, that can tell you a lot. Does anyone have any questions on their graphs, their adapted graphs?
I assume that a 50% change is considered big change.
That would be considered significant, yeah.
Right.
Yep. And so, again, just look at the characteristics and the factors and then think about, is that a good thing, you know, given what's going on or what it is that you're trying to accomplish? Is that, you know, something you're probably doing? Think about, am I doing this reactively? Am I doing it strategically? How much stress, you know, sometimes people will feel stress in their environment, not necessarily know where it's come from, and then see their DISC graphs and go, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. I'll give you a good example. I was working with a team in Virginia, and it was a leadership team, and I was doing a team building, and after I had gone through this process of, you know, people looking at their adapted graphs, at the next break, this woman called me over, and she said, well, you know, can you look at this and tell me what this means? So I looked at it, and her influence score was really high naturally. It was like 80%, I'd say. And adaptively, it was like 30%. So she had, you know, her eye had plummeted 50 points. And I looked at it, and I just, you know, knowing what I know about these graphs, I looked at her, and I said, are you okay? That was my question. She started crying. She just teared up immediately. And what had happened was she had had a really bad interaction with the VP of sales a couple weeks before, a very high dominant person, and he had screamed and yelled, and she'd taken it very personally, which, you know, the other styles do tend to do. They think the anger is personal or about them, and it had really affected her. It had affected her, just her general enthusiasm about being on the team and contributing and all that, and it was really obvious when we looked at her DISC assessment. So, yeah, it's a big adaptation, and you just want to ask yourself, you know, some questions about it.
Nancy, do you ever find that you can look at these DISC profiles and say, okay, here's my salesperson, here's my inside person, and by just looking at dominance and influence? Do you find anybody in sales that's effective if they don't have a high dominance or high influence?
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned those two, because whenever I benchmark a job, because every job has a behavioral, you know, DISC behavioral profile that's perfect for it, most sales positions come out high dominance, high influence, which you would assume. That doesn't mean someone can't sell if they're not high dominant, high influence, because in sales, the determining factor is actually somebody's motivation, not their behaviors.
Okay.
So what I have is I have a values assessment that I use, which measures salespeople's internal motivation, what they're motivated by, what they're passionate about, and there's a value or a motivator that trumps behavioral style.
Okay.
And it's called a high utilitarian value. And what I found is that if people don't have a high utilitarian value, they probably shouldn't be in sales. But even a high steadiness compliant person with a really high utilitarian value can sell. And what will have to happen is at times they will have to raise their dominance. But they will do it because they're motivated internally to do so. Just like you've probably met high dominant, high influence people before, and personality-wise, you thought they'd be great in sales. You know, sometimes we even hire them based on the fact that they look really good, and then they get there and they're not motivated to sell. So they actually had the right behavioral style, but they didn't have the right values.
Good one.
That can happen too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's move on to number four. How do we use DISC to improve relationships? And I'm talking personal or professional relationships. And the interesting thing about DISC is that, you know, people always ask me, well, which is it? Is it opposites attract, or is it birds of a feather flock together? And I'll tell you, with DISC, in personal relationships, it tends to be opposites attract. Romantic relationships especially, it seems like the D's and the S's of the world are attracted, the I's and the C's of the world are attracted. With values, if you're looking at somebody's values, that's the birds of a feather flock together scenario. So when you see things the same way as other people, you value the same things, you tend to be attracted to those people. Now, in a work environment, though, opposites attract behaviorally isn't always true. You know, you may find the high dominant, congregating with the high dominant people because they have the similar interests, and you've got the high compliant people here all talking about technology or something like that. And, of course, the high influence people are going to group with the high influence people. So in the work environment, it might be a little bit different. But no matter whether you're with people who are similar to you or people that are different than you, you're going to tend to have more conflict when you communicate with people who are the opposite behavioral style. So that would be the D's and the S's and the I's and the C's, okay? Even when you're attracted to that person. What my sister, who was in high, this will crack you up, was a high IS, married a high DC, they were complete behavioral opposites, always said to me was, opposites may attract, but it's hell living together. So this communication information is great for personal and professional relationships. So the things you need to do in order to improve a relationship or in order to improve or change anything is, one, you need awareness, right, which is what we're getting right now. Two, you need to understand the other person. And three, you need to be able to adapt yourself or reprogram how you handle certain situations. So, yes, unfortunately, the responsibility falls on us, the people who know this and have this skill, but it goes a long way with relationships. So here's the diagram that's there. It's two circles that overlap. And the red arrow is pointing to the overlap of the two circles. And what that part is, you can go ahead and shade that area where the two actually intersect. That shaded area is called the area of commonality. Okay? So that's how much do these two styles have in common. And I will tell you that the two people that would interact that would have the most commonality are going to be two high I's, okay? So high I's, we know what they're extroverted and they're people-oriented. So when they get together, it's an automatic connection. It's fun. It's, you know, they're like best friends. They've known each other 5 minutes and they're best friends. And other behavioral styles are looking on thinking they're crazy. But that's how much in common high I's will have with each other. The least common combinations, so the styles that will have the least amount of commonality are going to be the D's and the S's and the I's and the C's. Okay, and that makes sense because on the wheel in your assessment and on those tables that we were just working with, they're in the opposite quadrants. They're across from each other, which makes sense. So the D's and the S's are going to have the biggest challenge relating to each other, and the I's and the C's. And, you know, when you compare them side by side, you kind of start to understand why. So, for example, the D to the S, okay, here's the differences. It's a quick pace to a slow pace. It's an extrovert to an introvert. It's impatient to someone who's patient. It's someone who enjoys conflict versus someone who avoids conflict. It's someone who's quick to anger versus someone who's slow to anger. Someone who's has a very high sense of urgency to someone who has a low sense of urgency. A high risk to low risk. I mean, it almost sounds like they're opposite. Now, granted, the true opposite of a high dominant person is a low dominant person. But the high D and high S have enough opposite characteristics that makes it a challenging behavioral match in relationships. So what high dominant people have to do and have to be aware of is they have to not overpower the high steadiness, because that will be their tendency. So if you're a high dominant person and you're dealing with high steadiness people, you've got to be careful not to overpower them. You're going to have to work hard at building a trusting relationship with them, because they're slow to trust, and they're going to kind of look at you pretty skeptically as you come, you know, kind of charging in with your fancy ideas. And high dominant people are going to have to work a lot harder at listening, because high steadiness people do not speak up a lot. You know, they're very quiet, and high dominant people will usually just kind of run the relationship, and high steadiness people won't be saying what it is the high dominant person needs to hear. And believe me, high steadiness people have a ton of value and a ton of insight. So a high dominant person would do well to kind of hold back their opinions and what they're usually doing and listen to what high steadiness people have to say. On the other hand, high steadiness people, when dealing with high dominant people, they don't get off completely scot-free either. They've got some work to do as well. They're going to have to, it's their responsibility. So if you're a high steadiness, it's your responsibility not to be overpowered by the high dominant person. So you need to stand up to the high dominant person. It's really funny that, you know, people are kind of scared of high dominant people because of their impatience and their anger. But what's interesting is when you stand up to a high dominant person, they love it. They actually love it. So the biggest tip I can give high steadiness people in relationship is stand up to the high dominant people. Don't go along for the sake of harmony and peace and just kind of, you know, be the yes person. High dominant people actually can't stand that. And high steadiness people are usually prepared, so use your information. You know your stuff. You know, kind of let that guide you and build you up into kind of standing up to the high dominant person, especially when you know that you're right, because they'll actually respect that. High influence and high compliant people, again, these are behavioral almost opposites. You've got high influence first, I'm going to talk about, and then compliant. So you've got optimistic to pessimistic, feelings to facts, extroverted to introverted, high risk to low risk, people-oriented versus data-oriented. So again, they have very few behavioral commonalities between the two. So high-influence people, if you're a high I and you need to go deal with or talk to or persuade a high-compliant person, you've got to slow down and keep a tight rein on your emotions. Because if you get emotional, the high-compliant person, like, loses credibility for you. You need to use information and data. It's not high-influence people's strong suit, but it's what's going to influence a high-compliant person. And you need to reduce your gestures and not initiate physical contact. High eyes, we're the touchy, feely people of the world. We're always touching people's shoulders and, you know, kind of elbowing them and trying to get a reaction out of them. High-compliant people, it actually says in their profile, their DISC assessment, like, don't get within 3 feet of them. Like, respect their space, which is something high-influence people have a hard, you know, time remembering. The high-compliant people, now they've got some work to do as well, when they're talking and communicating with high insulin people, they need to loosen up. They need to become more stimulating, more fun, more people-focused, and be less likely to, you know, say that's wrong or the information doesn't show. So they've actually got to be a little bit more, less reliant on their data and information and be a little bit more involved and people-oriented and in the relationship. That's going to go a long way with high-influence people. So those are the opposites. Those are the biggest challenges for each of the styles. So next, I just wanted to talk really quickly, because I know we're getting right near the end of the hour, about how to apply this information to improve business results. Well, as we just talked about really briefly, this information works really well in sales. I've done several things with the DISC tool, along with the values assessment I use. One, looking at current salespeople. Sometimes performance issues are not that you have a bad person necessarily. You've got someone who's a mismatch to the job. They've either got the values, but their behavior needs some work, or they've got the behaviors, but they're not motivated. So I always say to people, before you spend another dime on sales training, which is about the products or techniques or anything like that, please, please, please make sure that your people are motivated and behaviorally able to sell. This also works really well in hiring. People don't even think about the fact that you can assess candidates' DISC style and see if they match the job that you're hiring them for. But that's absolutely legal to do, and I have a process for doing that. Matter of fact, over 50% of my business is doing hiring with my clients, making sure they're hiring the right people. DISC obviously is great for conflict resolution. This is a tool that's great for HR managers to use when dealing with employees or employee and managers who aren't getting along. A lot of times what you'll find is that people have different behavioral styles, so their communication is just really challenging. One thing I was talking about, I don't know if you heard when you got on, I was speaking with Patty about, which is DISC certification. I now am to the point where I'm certifying other people to become DISC certified and use this tool to do hiring and sales training and conflict resolution, because I don't have time to do it all. So I'm actually creating my own little army of DISC wizards. I call them apprentices right now. So if there's anyone in your organization that's either in the HR field or doing training, they can be certified to administer the DISC tool internally. And then last, of course, team building. That's usually the place that people go with once they get their DISC results and assessments. They see them and they think, now I want to know what my team members are, which is, a natural place to take this. So what I've done is I've actually created an offer for you. If just for people that are on this teleclass, it's a special offer to be able to do DISC on your team and then have a team debriefing. But before I tell you about that, I just wanted to ask if anybody had questions on their results or anything that we didn't cover today.
Nancy, can you talk just a second about the wheel at the end?
Sure.
And how the graph corresponds to that?
Absolutely. Thanks, Patty, for reminding me. The wheel, which is the last page of your assessment, I'm going to be straight with you. The wheel is great when you're using it in different applications. But when you're just looking at somebody's results, one person's results, I tend to always look at their bar graphs that we had talked about today. So the wheel is another visual representation of both those bar graphs, two pages before it. So the interesting thing is, or the thing that is useful, is that it plots your natural graph and your adapted graph on the wheel. And so even if you didn't know anything about DISC and you just looked at it, basically how it works is the further away your star is from your circle, the more you're adapting, okay? And the closer they are together, the less you're adapting. If you want to see exactly how much, percentage-wise or which factor is moving, I would still go look at your bar graph. But if you're looking just to the extent or the intensity of your adapting, look at the wheel. And so people, again, they'll ask me if it's not moving hardly at all, if I move one section over, is that a good or a bad thing? Once again, you have to go back to, what does your environment need from you, and what do you need to be doing to be successful, and is that going to get you where you want to go? If you're adapting adaptive styles all the way across the wheel, that means you're adapting a lot. and I would ask those exact same questions. Are you okay? You know, how stressed are you? Is that what your environment needs, and is that a good thing? The wheel becomes really useful when you use it to do things like plotting a team, is you can put an entire team on this wheel and see if people are in the areas they need to be in, where conflict might occur naturally on the team between people on different sides of the wheel. You can also use this wheel to do hiring, because you can put the work environment in here, and it would fall somewhere, you know, on the wheel, and then you could put a candidate in here and see behaviorally how close of a match are they to the job. So the wheel has a lot of different applications, but when I'm interpreting someone's results, I tend to still look at the bar graph.
But on the bar graph, there's four areas that you're looking at, and on the wheel, there's one circle and one star. So does it just combine all of those into one area?
Yep. Because okay. if you look on the wheel, you've got D up in the right-hand corner, I in the bottom,
right,
F on the left, and then C on the top. And then those eight different sections, the persuader combines D and I.
Okay.
The relator combines I and S. The coordinator combines S and C. And the implementer combines C and D. And Patty, since you're going to be getting certified, I actually break down this wheel and teach you exactly, you know, how each one shifts, where it's moving, what does it mean, does that mean the S?
And what all those numbers mean in each one of the little
each
sections?
One of those numbers, there's a graph behind that number.
Got it.
We don't show it to you here, it'd be too confusing.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but behind it, each of those, there's 60 different graphs that are plotted on this wheel. The 60 most common disc graphs are plotted on this wheel.
Okay.
But there's like 324 that aren't plotted on here. So every once in a while, you'll get someone who can't be plotted on the wheel.
Got
okay.
it.
So anyways, well, it's good that we just talked about the wheel, because in the team work that I do, when I do a team building, that's part of what I do, is I plot the team on the wheel so we can look at the team composite. And the team building that I do, it's usually a 1 or 2 day process in person, you know, kind of like your typical off-site. But the challenge is nowadays, teams aren't necessarily able to carve out that much time to meet. I'm also finding, you know, flying across the country every other week doesn't necessarily work for my schedule all the time. So what I've created recently is something I call a team debriefing process. And what that is, it's the same process. We still do the DISC assessments on everyone on the team. We still look at the team composite and the dynamics of the team. But instead of me coming there and doing, you know, an in-person full-day session, we do a 2-hour virtual team debriefing, which is basically everyone has their results, and then we meet, like, either, you know, on the phone or in a conference room or something like that, and we go through a presentation, but I'm on the phone. It seems to work really, you know, well. It's fast. It's, of course, not as personal, so my high eye doesn't like it as much. But it seems to be really efficient, and I've had a lot of teams starting to take advantage of it. And then afterwards, they can decide if they want to do more or not, if they then want to fly me out and kind of take it further. But the process is really easy. Your team goes online just like you did. They complete a DISC assessment. I do my work on this end. I compile the information. You, if you're the team leader, we debrief it. We talk about anything that, you know, came up that I see that, you know, might need to be addressed. But then basically what happens is we just have a team meeting where we go through DISC and we teach people DISC. We teach them about themselves, like kind of like what we did today. They learn about their team because we're looking at everybody plotted on the wheel. And then we actually talk about, you know, the team and the, you know, communication, some potential for conflict, some resolution, some, you know, ideas for how to deal with it. And teams usually get a lot of insight from the process. And I get a question quite a bit, which is, you know, going forward, what should we do now with this information? How should we hire? You know, if we hire somebody, should we make sure we fill in the holes that we have? So we usually get really great conversations from this, and I think people really start to use the information even within 2 hours. I always tell people I can't guarantee behavioral change from a 2-hour process, but I can guarantee that people will learn a lot and they'll have a lot of fun. And at the end of every session I've ever done, I've asked people, did you learn a lot? Yes. Did you have fun? Yes. Okay. Well, let's see. What's the time on that? 9 minutes over. That's not unusual for high I, just so you know. We're not the most precise when it comes to time. So now that we're at the end, does anyone else have any other questions they might want answered?
Nope.
Okay. Well, then
I just want to tell you that the Dow Jones went up 900 points.
Wow.
Since you've been on the phone.
See,
so you are an influencer.
That is the positive energy of a high influence person right there. And I think we combined energy today. That was probably
good.
What helped.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Nancy.
Have a great day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.